Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 3035. That's 3035. I'm Carol Levine. I'm Vice President of NASCA. And tonight we're going to have a really good guest on. She's been on before, but it was a long time ago. Yes, it was. So we decided to bring Lori back. Her name is Lori Purcell, and she is from Bayshore, and that is New York, and I would know that. So anyway, we're going to have a good show, but first I'm going to read the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse mission statement. A lot of times there's people that listen through the computer. I have a few friends that are listening through the computer tonight. So, and I'm sure there's more. But anyway, the point is this. If you want to call in and be a part of this, she's got quite a story. It's 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. And then you push number 1 if you want to be on, you know, on the panel. Or if you just want to listen, you don't push anything. You just sit there and listen to the show, okay? Okay. So let me read the statement, and then we'll get on from there. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways, and it's pretty easy. Number 1 is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse. Presenting the fact that shows child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone, and it does. Number 2, offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay? Now, I always talk a lot about prevention, and I will go over the 3 really quick, and Lori can get herself settled. Prevention, that's something that I believe is like a community thing, and I wish it were more of a community thing. We do have people who work in the community, especially in the more urban areas. We need it everywhere. It doesn't have to be just urban, where they try to, you know, work with at-risk kids. What does that mean? That means kids who might be, you know, joining gangs. They come from poor backgrounds where they're in the sense. I don't mean that economically exactly. I mean bad backgrounds where there's a lot of trouble in the family. Dysfunctional is the word. And a lot of times they turn to the streets. I've seen it happen too often. I was out on the streets. A lot of us were out on the streets on NASCA. We understand. We get it. Okay. So they work with, you know, kids who are at risk many times, one being the Guardian Angels. I'm very fond of them. And then there are other groups out there like Crime Watch and Neighborhood Watch and, well, other groups too, I'm sure. I think the Angels are more capable of working with the kids, though. I mean, that's my gut feeling on that because they really get involved. They go into the schools and they do all different kinds of things. And then on November 2nd, I guess it is, or 4th, I think it's the 4th, I have to check that, I think it's November 4th, we're going to have Tammy on, Tammy Cricket. Yes, she is. She was one of the angels, the very first angels that I had on the show. And I met her, we started talking, and then she introduced me to other angels, and they're, to me, they're a delight. Because anyone who works with community cares about people. And anyone who cares about people is my kind of person, okay? Too many of us grew up in backgrounds where we didn't have people who cared, and it does terrible damage. All right, now, and then intervention is where you sit and you talk to a child if you know they've been, you know, abused or you suspect it. And if you can, you gather information. You can take it to the police department and let them deal with it, and they'll probably turn it over to DIFAS or, you know, one of the others. And then maybe you've saved a life, okay, maybe. Right thing, that's for sure, okay. And when you do interview a child, if you want to call it that, it's not really supposed to be an interview. You start talking to the kid, get a little friendly with the kid in the sense that you see him a couple of days, ask him how they're doing and all this other stuff. And by doing that, they feel like they have maybe a confidant, you know, someone they can turn to and trust. Because when kids come from bad homes, a lot of times sexual abuse is coming right from the home, and incest is what I'm speaking about. And so it's just a matter of things that, you know, that people can do to help kids. And then, of course, we have recovery, all right, recovery. And I'm going to do a show on recovery because too many people ask me about recovery. Can I really recover? Yes, you can. But we have on our website, which is NASCA, that's NASCA.org. That's NASCA.org. And if you go down to the red the blocks, if you scroll down a little bit, each block has a different topic. And you would want to go to prevention, and that's over to the right-hand side. And open that up, and you can learn how to, you know, speak to children and, you know, and in your own home, for God's sake. If it's a good home, you love your kids, you want to take care of them, hey, teaching them how to cross the street is good, but it's not enough. All right? Today they need all kinds of help and instruction. And I'll get into that. I might make a show out of that on another night. But anyway, all right. So with Lori here, she has had quite a life, and of course, we on NASCA, we don't take yardsticks and measure whose story is worse than whom, okay? But a lot of us have had a lot of problems. And so anyway, she's going to start telling us her story, and it's going to be, you know, from the beginning, okay, the beginning of her childhood abuse, what she remembers, and go from there. I see Bill is here. I'm going to have him say hi to Lori. There you go.
Hey, Lori,
you're open.
How are you doing? Yeah, thanks
hi.
For coming on. Hi.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we are glad to have you. It's been a while.
I know. It's medical.
I should explain to our listeners that Lori has been around NASCA for a long time, but she's been kind of missing in action. And so we're delighted to see her pop back up, and we really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you so, so much. I'm glad I'm back.
You too. All right. Thank you, Carol.
No, you're welcome. So I'm going to let her, I want her to take a couple of deep breaths, and I know she's had a chance to do that, and then to start, you know, telling her show. Okay, and don't, you know, don't hold anything back. Tell what you want to say. No one's pressuring you. Hey. We're survivors, right?
We are.
Yes, we are,
by
God. But we're still standing. That's what I always say. We're still standing. So remember, there's people, you know, that are listening that don't know enough about child abuse. And that's the truth.
Yeah,
Lori.
It is.
So
the
when
truth,
they hear our
is.
Stories, yeah, when they hear our stories, we're teaching
they
them.
Run.
Yeah.
They
oh,
run
boy.
Us.
I know. Yeah, I do.
Well, some people were lucky enough to have avoided it most of their lives. Some people just weren't. And in my case, I was one of the unlucky ones. I was born into it. There was a marriage, it was like an arranged marriage from way back when, and on a blind date that Jack and Gilda, my biological parents, met, and they got married. And I have no idea why, because from my earliest memory, which is actually in a baby carriage in the front of the yard, where I couldn't lift my head up. I remember being so angry that she kept putting me out there, and I'd have to wait for Jack to come home, and all the fighting would start. Well, that's what I kind of live with every day. Those two hated each other from day one. I never saw any kind of affection or anything nicely said. So I was one of the unlucky ones. I am the middle child. In a month, I'm going to be 65 already. I wasn't expected to make it past 60, so my doctor actually was kind of had a laughing session with me that I'm still walking around, you know, which is always good to hear. Always good to hear.
Yes.
I had an older brother, a year older than me. His name was Andrew. He was clinically crazy. He was born with a condition with his throat, something with his throat where food wouldn't get down. So he wasn't actually saved until he was 3 months old and within hours of death. I saw pictures where his skull bones were showing. He was his birth weight at 3 months old. So he was brain damaged as far back as, you know, I ever knew him. What I remember of him when I, you know, first came around was him running in and out of the door all the time. There was nobody around. Gilda was a psychotic, kind of sociopathic, evil person that lived in her own world. She would talk to herself all the time, smoke a cigarette, drink coffee, but no words would come out of her mouth. So she was really in another world. Well, when she came out of that world is when she had kids. And she didn't like kids. I don't know why they even wanted kids. But here I came along. So I was basically, you know, tossed aside just like my brother was. And I was like a quiet kid. I think I was born that way. I mean, I have a sister who's 2.5 years younger. She's very different than me, very sociable, very like a happy, well, was a happy type person. So dark personalities all together with these kids, we didn't get along at all. And Andrew, being on his own and free and crazy, he used to go out and break things, cut up frogs, destroy things. He got a real kick out of destruction and beating me up. That's when I met Andrew. He spotted me. I can remember all the way back in the kitchen. I was new to the kitchen table. I don't know how they fed me before, but he spotted me, and from that day on, all he did was seek me out and beat me up for no reason. And, you know, I learned to protect my head very early in life. Gilda was the same way. You know, in the beginning, there was nobody around to call out to. So it was a beating that he had to stop on his own. There was no one to stop him. So that was like for 2.5 years, that's what I did with him. And he was basically all through his life was doing crazy things like starting fires and killing animals and beating up other kids and actually stabbing them. And as he got older, I saw him run his car into two separate kids. I mean, his temper was off the walls. I've never seen anything like his temper when he went off. But he was so brain damaged, and I still, you know, back then I didn't care, and I actually didn't even know what had happened to him until I found that picture and started asking the family members questions, what had happened to him, because he can't stare somebody in the eye. He'll see you, but he won't focus. So all I knew about him is he had brown hair, glasses, and gray eyes, and he would always come and beat me up. And then there would be, you know, I turn around and run. That's my relationship with him. So that's what I had to put up with. Now, Andrew, who wasn't fed anyway, none of us, it turned out, were fed. Gilda would stay up in the room all day long. I didn't even know she was in the house. We had a Cape Cod, and I was on the ground floor. So until it was where I could, she started just screaming out one day, you know, my name. So I remember when I started to learn how to climb the stairs up, and that's when I found out that's where she stayed. So it was, she had like that room, and I turned left and I saw that there was another bunch of doors, but I didn't know what it was. And she started telling me immediately to go into the cabinet and get some bread, because basically she only had bread and milk in the house. But whatever she ate, we didn't count, and make her a sandwich. Thinking, and I didn't speak for a very long time, but I'm thinking to myself, aren't I too young for this? Like, I just made it up the stairs. I don't know how, I don't even know what it is to do. Because I did nothing. So it's like I'm guessing just about when I was starting to walk around and out of the room, that's when I started, you know, knowing the layout of the house. And immediately I noticed that the house was filthy. I think I was born with this thing against filth, but maybe because I was so short, you know, that I could see it and always down getting beat up on the ground. But I've never seen her clean anything. So I lived, like, it was filthy. I just couldn't handle it, you know, even at that age. So all day long she stayed up there. Andrew did his thing. Hopefully, you know, the bruises or whatnot didn't hurt as bad as the day before. And then Jack would come home, and it was around 3 o'clock. Now, back then, he got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to this job all the way into the city to work, which he did every single day, didn't take a day off, so he could provide for his family. This is what I would think he was doing and why. Because I was just learning, and in that block that I lived on, I was the only one my age. So there were no other kids around there, except for older ones. So when he came home, of course, nothing was done, and there was no food in the house. He had nothing to eat. So the screaming started. Jack had a violent temper. I can't say if Gilda was worse than him. All I know is that she just was pure evil. Jack had another side to him, and he was very, like, sociable. But Jack turned out to be a pedophile, and I turned out to be his obsession. So eventually my grandmother had told me that I was unusually potty trained very, very early in life. So I'm thinking that Jack was messing around with me from the very beginning, because I know Gilda didn't do anything. She didn't do laundry, she didn't do the sweep, she didn't do anything, cook nothing. So it was like an everyday thing with him, and he escalated as I got older. I didn't know what was going on. I mean, it was like one day when I was, I guess, old enough to sit at the kitchen table, and actually Gilda was making what she called dinner. She put I was sitting on phone books. I was very short. And I just leaned into the bowl to see what it was. And all of a sudden, Jack, who was sitting at the head of the table, took the bowl. It was cereal and milk, and he poured it over my head. I was not understanding what was going on, so immediately I started, you know, to cry. And he just, it went into hysterical, because I think Gilda was surprised, and I think he had an agenda all along of what he was going to do with me that night. So he just decides, he throws his chair out, my chair is knocked down, he grabs me, and he puts me on his sidearm like a football, like he's carrying. And he's looking now at Gilda, who was at the other end of the table in the room, and their eyes locked. No words came out of their mouth. I'm on the side, and I could barely look my head up. But I heard nothing, and I saw Gilda's eyes communicating with him. And what she was doing was actually like a surprise that Jack did that. And she gave him the okay to do what he did next. So I'm still crying, and the next thing I know, he takes me into the shower, which it was not familiar to me because we were not cleaned or anything. And ever if we were, it was in a bath. I was never in a shower. Takes off my clothes, and I'm still dripping, and I'm crying. And he turns on this water from above, gets himself in there, and I'm only tall enough where I was up to his knee, and he was 6 foot tall. So I was only up to his knee, and I'm getting bombarded by all this stuff, freaking out. And he first was like starting with my hair, you know, let's get the milk out of your hair type thing. And then he just, my body wasn't tall, so he just went right in there. And then he started washing every part of me that there was. And that was my first real trauma with him, not my last. But that was my first memory of what he was doing to me. So since Gilda, you know, she never came to the door of the bathroom to see what was going on, because I was still like, you know, you get into such a trauma that your brain is so, you don't know where you are at one point because you're so traumatized, and that's where I was. So the whole bath thing went on. Gilda said nothing. She wasn't even at the door. And then he decides he's drying me. Well, I didn't see the reason that he dried everything else, and my hair was still dripping wet. He was not fixated on anything else. So that was the beginning of my life with pedophile Jack. He molested me every single night. I had my sister come into the shared bedroom with me. She was like, about 2.5 years younger than me, and I didn't discover her until she was a year old. She was left behind a door in a room in her crib, and the story went from her, Gilda's sister, that she told my father to put us in foster care and put us and divorce Gilda, which would have made sense. But Jack, being the pedophile he is and having me to himself, decided not to. So what she would do is her name was Anita. She told me that she would feed my sister in there and that she would, you know, change her. No one was allowed in there. She said that she had bed sores and feet sores on the bottom of her feet. Mm. And I was like, oh, my God. But one day, Gilda wasn't in the house, and the aunt, which is a great aunt that lived two doors down, was babysitting, and I heard someone behind the door. So I finally went into the door, and I saw my sister. And she's standing up. She got her first haircut, and she was born, I saw pictures, with no hair at all. So she was in there for quite a while before I found her. And she was so happy, and I tried trying to climb into the crib, and my aunt's family told me to get out. But the secret was out. There was a person behind the door. So I remember taking her, you know, my father had to take her out of the crib, and she was walking. The girl was walking, and she was in the hallway, and Andrew came by. So there was now five of us, and he discovered Susie. It didn't take him long at all. He started, instead of beating me up, he started beating Susie up. And this went on all the time. And in the beginning, I was kind of relieved that, because I needed a break. I was getting hit too much. But I didn't understand why or how or any of it, because it was all crazy. And there was nobody that came to stop them. I became the one to scream to Gilda to get him off of her. Now, it was like I was the guard. I was there to break up the fighting, get Andrew some which way, out of our lives. And Susie, who became, once she got out, I remember her singing and dancing and smiling, and just, she was just so happy. She was really just so happy. Mm-hmm. That's not how she is now. That's not how she is now. What happened to her, I mean, it's her story, but what I know of what happened to her ruined her life, and she never is going to come out of it. She was offered many times and to help, you know, get her into, like, drug rehab, get her into a therapist. I know what happened to you because I was there. So she did, but She wasn't interested, so she didn't make it. She's still alive, but she's, what is she, young? I'm going to be 65, so whatever, but she's a total druggie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I haven't seen her in about 10 years. I mean, there's no connection to her at all. You know, I don't, as far as I'm concerned, I don't have a blood sister. I have other sisters,
right.
though.
Mm-hmm.
So it turned out that Jack, who used to, you know, play with her and whatever, didn't like her. He was always chasing her around the house, beating up on her. Then Andrew was beating up on both of us when Jack was on her. And then Gilda, when she came out of her psychosis, and that would be to turn on the stove so the water would boil for her coffee. She used to have instant coffee all the time. And that that tea whistle would go on for a half an hour. I mean, she was really out of it half the time. I had to tell her to turn it off. I learned to use the stove very early, and she actually burned my hand on the stove to teach me how hot it was. So, and she did the same thing with an iron. I was too short to even be ironing it, but she demanded I iron, so I got burned. And that's how she was with me. She didn't care about injuries or any of it. And I believe she
ask you something, honey. Hold on a second. All right. By that time, okay, now you're ironing. You're trying to iron, right? And you turn the stove on to boil water or whatever you're supposed to do. How old were you then, and were you going to school?
Well, I was at that age. I went to school at 4 years old. My birthday landed on that way. But I wasn't much higher on the oven, and I was, you know, to really reach it well. You know, if I had a thought on the other half, I'd have to walk around. I wasn't that tall. So I was kind of short. Too short to be doing it and too young to be doing it.
Right.
I had to do what she said because she would break out in these psychotic rages on me and she would beat the hell out of me with her fists, no less. And it was almost like a seizure type thing, you know, we had to get it out of her system. And I didn't talk so much to her. It was just me saying no. Basically, when she was telling me to get her this or go, she was teaching me to clean. I guess she got sick of it, too, and I didn't know how to do any of that. But even back then, I said, I'm thinking, aren't you supposed to be doing the cleaning? I'm just not understanding this.
You are five, and then she's teaching me how to clean the house and boil
and
water and do the ironing. And oh, boy.
We didn't even have color TV.
Oh, geez. Let me ask you something. Oh, okay. Kids go to school. Now, of course, things are a little bit better. We have to admit somewhat better. I'm not going to say how much better. But when teachers see kids that are bruised, now you talk about all of your bruising and stuff.
Yeah.
Did anyone
what
ever
happened?
Say to you, you know?
Nobody ever talked to me in school. Now, when I was 4 years old when I entered school. But in the summer before, you know, September started, my brother decided that he was going to drag me from the living room up the stairs, and I had no reason why. He was blabbering something to me, but he doesn't look at you. He didn't look at you, and I didn't understand. And I knew I couldn't scream, but I wasn't having a good time being dragged up the stairs. But he dragged me all the way up, right by Gilda's door, where she's at. Down the hallway, and it turns out his bedroom was on the top floor. I've never seen it before that. And he's like, I'm looking around going, what kind of room is this? It was really bad. He says, see that window? And I'm like, I look up, I go, yeah, you're going out it. And I just was like, what? He says, you're going out the window. And the fighting, that's when it started. You know, I'm not going anywhere. I tried to get out of his door. He slammed it. It was enough ruckus that Gilda should have woken up, but Gilda didn't. And he actually got me and picked me up. And after a while, he was pushing out parts of my body to where he got me where I was hanging on the outside of the window by my fingers on that gray casing they used to use for the windows when they put them in back then. And he was
peeling off
one of my fingers at a time. And I'm looking down. I swear I stepped out of my body because I could see the terror on my face. And I fell. I landed two stories. I fell on my back and my head. My back I had hit on one of the scallop bricks on. And since I was so little, it took up a lot of my back. And my head, the back of my head, actually made an indentation in the ground. That's how hard I hit. My head is actually flat. I mean, that's a fall that everybody said I should have never survived. And I honestly wish I never did. So, thud, I hear. It turns out he came running down the stairs after a while. I couldn't move. All I did was just look up in the air, and I looked at a blue sky, and I saw a cloud. And I heard him, and I couldn't say anything. So I heard him run back in through the store. He had doors, the slamming doors. So I watched the cloud go from one side of the sky to the other, and then I heard the door, and I managed to move my neck, and I saw Gilda for the first time standing up, you know, full standing, and I was thinking to myself, I didn't know she was that tall, and I didn't know she could move fast. So she comes over, scoops me up, brings me into the kitchen, and I'm thinking I'm going to get help because I was really hurting. She opens her arms. I just fall to the floor, and she goes into one of her rage attacks, and she starts beating the crap out of me. I did break my back. I mean, there's a whole bunch of this stuff from the fall, but she, at that time, she was just beating on me on my head. I was, like, trying to protect my head while trying to bend a broken back and other bones and whatnot. I mean, she was really wild. And, of course, no one ever took me to a doctor. So by the time I did get to school, and this is from non-feeding, my ribs were sticking out. From the fall, my rib cage had twisted, and you could see a bulge from my shirt. You could see my collarbone. That was broken. That was still out there. And there were all other kinds of problems that I was having, like with my back of my head being crushed. Whatever works in your brain didn't work for me. Like I'd fall a lot. I couldn't, you know, stay straight. I couldn't use the scissors right. I had trouble. I had a lot of perception problems. None of the teachers did anything about anything. They just did not care. And
that's awful. Hold on a second. I want to see if Bill wants to ask you a question or something.
Okay.
Well, I know her story pretty well, and I also put together the recent bio, so not a mystery to me, the story itself. But it is a mystery to me how a little kid, when she was a little kid, you know, could survive all this. And she barely survived in some cases. And you'll hear as she comes through the, you know, the next couple of chapters, how horrible she's, you know, she's been damaged and all the things that she's had to put up with. Well, she's here as a child abuse survivor, okay? And I want the audience to understand that she's not complaining, but she is recognizing that the trauma that she experienced as a kid, violent trauma in her case, and some sexual trauma, of course, and emotional trauma, all those things, really made a difference in her life, and now she's, you know, working to get her life back, kind of, or improve it anyway. There's a lot of obstacles, though. The physical stuff, you know, is definitely a big obstacle. But then there's all the emotional stuff that most of us who are survivors have to deal with. And she's got a big plate, a big full plate. So that's why I want to say that Glory's a trooper. We're very lucky, really, to have you here tonight, Lori, and I don't take that for granted, okay? Now, she's not been on for many months, but I hope that she'll return, maybe in the capacity of just calling in person or something, on a panel or whatever, and then we'll have her back to tell her story again, all right? But
I do. I've been lost in medical all this time. That's where I've been. That's exactly where I've been, because I was on the panel for a while.
Yeah.
And
well, we have space to have you back. We'd love to have you back, okay?
Yeah, there's my family, my Nashka family, who I would go on with.
Well, it's true.
I was very active. I mean, you have to actually help people, you know, show people that you can come through things, and that's why I came on. Because it's as bad as it sounds, you know, it really did kind of sound bad, but I did survive. I'm still here. I'm 65 almost.
It's a miracle, believe me. I get it.
Oh, thank you.
She's a miracle child. Listen to her. Listen to this story, everyone. This is outrageous. We all have horrible stories. But this one here, oh, boy. It's a good thing I didn't live next door to you. Let me tell you that right now.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's enough.
I would have done something, you bet.
None of the neighbors did anything. They all hated us, and I never knew why, but they, you know, met Gilda first. She ruined it for everybody else. I mean, like, I remember when I was 2.5 years old, Susie was in the carriage at a neighbor's barbecue party, and a big pool they had, and there were a bunch of the big kids in there, and they were all looking, like, away from me, and I heard, all I did was crawl up to sit on the bench because there was nobody there to play with me. So Gilda says, put her in the pool. So he puts me into this pool, doesn't tell anybody I'm in there, without floaties, and walks away. And by the time I was able to get my hand onto that top rim, because it was so little, he was halfway back. And I went under a few times, and that was the first time I saw the white light.
Wow.
I woke up to wet. My chest was killing me, my back was killing me, and I opened up my eyes, and all these neighbors were around me. They had to resuscitate me, and this was just from him walking away, you know, and not telling anybody. So stuff like that, you know, you got to really watch. You know, I thought he was crazy at that point. I really did. But everybody walked away after I was there. You know, they didn't even offer me a blanket or nothing, a towel, some food. I stayed hidden that entire day. Nobody cares. And if nobody cares, nothing gets fixed. And if nothing gets fixed, it stays broken and only gets worse. So that's why I keep going. Plus, I have to teach my son the obstacles that come along in life that you think you can't get over, you can in some which way. So that's what has kept me going. You know? So that was like the fun part of before school. And that was a fun
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I didn't have a good time in school either. I was dressed in rags. Nobody liked me. I probably smelled. But it was, well, it was food to us. My father made sure that we had money for food. And that's how I lived. We didn't, there was nothing on, you know, in the cupboards, in the refrigerator. There was milk for her coffee, and she had peanut butter and jam in the refrigerator. But that was it, and the molded bread. My father lived on chocolate chip cookies. My brother lived on my father's cookies. And the fighting always started because those two also hated each other. I found out my father used to beat him mercilessly. Oh, it was horrible. And we were outcast from all the relatives because they hated Gilda, and they all lived in the city. And we lived out on Long Island. So it was actually nobody helping us, nobody. So you wither away. You know, more things come, which they did. I mean, my father's abuse never stopped. It just got worse and worse as I grew. By that time, you know, Gilda was beating up on me regularly because I ended up having to do, you know, everything, and it was too much for me, you know, being done at laundry. I think you have to be taller than the dryer to actually be old enough to do the laundry, but I was not.
Right.
You know, nothing. I mean, Saturday, her mother, thank God for my grandmother, We used to go into the city, and for us, it meant food. That's what it meant
right.
for us, because that's when we ate a meal. I mean, occasionally, mm-hmm. you know, maybe a couple times during the week, my father would take us for a hamburger or a sandwich, but the rest of the time, no. So all of us, we were all skin and bones.
Right.
But still, nothing. Nobody, and with my brother, I think most of the people were keeping their younger kids in the house away from him because he was allowed to roam free. But it was crazy. And the school knew also from my brother how bad it was at home because they used to call all the time to get Gilda to take him, put him in special ed or a psych ward or someplace. And the police were constantly at the house. Everybody saw, even the teachers that had come to the house had seen what was going on. But nobody did anything. So we were,
you see,
was
that
just,
was my point. Hold on a second.
Yeah, that's when you were talking, that's exactly
it.
I
can't believe that. You see, all these people involved, I mean, the teachers see it, the police see it, and the neighborhood knows about it, okay, community, ha-ha. They know about it, and yet nobody did anything.
I mean, he lit the house
that's
on
so
fire.
Good.
Do you think the fire department would have called, you know, told the police? The kid lit the house on fire. I mean, he was really, like, really, really deranged. But not even the fire department reported him as a problem. And he lit the woods in the back on fire. He was a firebug. You know, he liked that kind of stuff. So that was the beginning part of my life. You know, I tried to do as much as I could. I tried to guard my sister, even though she turned into a horror because I was the only one. And as she told me in later years, I didn't care what kind of attention I got, but as long as I got it, because she was the worst sister ever. She would take everything I owned and literally throw it all over the place or rip it up or whatever she could do to get me, you know, pissed off so she would get her attention. I mean, I don't understand it, but that's what she did. So those were the years. You know, a bunch of screaming, a bunch of police, a whole bunch of fighting between the two of them, and total insanity. And yet I still had to go present myself as semi-normal in school. Thankfully, I ended up with Gilda's intelligence, although the memory part was damaged. I was able to understand everything. But when it came out into where if something wasn't logical, like history was not logical to me, you know, I could figure it out. So as long as these teachers saw that I was getting A's all through, they liked me. They didn't care what it looked like, but they liked looking. Oh, look, I got this kid who could do, you know, this kind of work. And the brains were originally there. I mean, I could have been somebody. You know, like
you are somebody. You are somebody.
Yeah, but in a field that, you know, was taken away from me because of the memory. They used to tell me I had a memory that I could have been a doctor, but I didn't have the personality. This is what they told me. I was like, thank you very much. I appreciate the support.
I think you're a great gal. I see nothing wrong with your personality. Yes, I do. I think you're fine.
Yeah.
And you can still do something. Do something.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to think about it because I'm not so positive. That's a joke.
I can't hear what you said. I'll laugh, though. There you go. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the only way I can look at things is chuckle about it. It's the only thing that was, that's what how I got out. I mean, I did have a good sense of humor. You know,
right.
There you go. There you go. You know, I have to say something here. I get on the night owls, I get all these different kind of calls, okay? But one thing I always try to do is have people laugh because, you know, that's good for the soul. It is so good for the soul. When you're laughing, no matter how you feel the laughter, then all of a sudden sort of like takes over. Some people I put to sleep. I actually do. It's like I'm sitting there reading them a story. I don't even take notice of it or feel bad about it. Hey, I got him to go to sleep. Great. Okay,
pretty good. How funny is that?
Yeah.
I first heard myself laugh. I was in eighth grade. That's when I first heard mm-hmm. myself laugh. And then ever since then, I hadn't stopped.
That's good.
And it turned out to be therapeutic, you know, because there are really some funny things in this world. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just did. Yeah. Raquel, a lot of years, though. But we clicked right away. We clicked right away. All of us did. I mean, part of my family. Never forgot to, although, you know, I've had, like, a lot of medical problems, to say the least, after from this. From, you know, as the years went by, I've got, like, the osteoporosis. I've had 9 mini-strokes. I've had, like, 11 concussions. I'm diagnosed mm-hmm. with anoxic brain damage. So if I look at something, by the time I'm looking right back, I forgot what I saw. So this is real serious, you know, drama to everything in my life. And the constant pain, you know, from my back. I've got scoliosis from where I hit the brick. And then it goes into another kind of turn on the top right. Still, everything is, since it wasn't fixed, you know, stayed. Mm-hmm. And I wore full body braces most of my adult life. Mm-hmm. I'm in no better position now. I mean, I can't go. I can't really walk. I walk, I fall. You know, it's to the point where it's like, well, come get you, don't worry. I'm like, okay. You know, I'm sure there's something I can do down here. That's how I look at it.
Well, you know, I think you're very brave. Okay, I think you are. I think you're very brave. We had such a long conversation a couple of days ago. And I got off the phone thinking to myself, finally you said, Carol, you better go and take your pills or something for my heart. But, you know, I thought to myself, she's been through so, so much, and so many of us have been through so, so much. And it does change you, of course, you know.
Oh, I'm different.
But, of course you are. But you have a very strong nature about you that's good. You're good, Lori.
When I see something that's just not right, and my family was just not right, I can't sit by and do nothing. I just can't.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm like that with other people. You know, I mean, all through my life, and anybody, I just cannot turn my back on anyone. That's just the way I was built. I came that way. You know, if you know you come that way, you don't try to run from it. And I don't. So people all along, even though I haven't been, you know, on with you, I mean, I still do my thing because I'm on the computer and, you know, I get in groups and, you know, in my adult life, you know, when it became, I was with the Guardians of the Children for a while, I just don't remember how long, that patch on my back attracted so many people that would come to me in those stores it was happening, and they were telling me practically their life stories of their abuse. Yeah, so I thought I was still doing something to help, you know, on the outside, because that's what I have to do. That I know that's why I'm on this planet. So I'm going with the flow.
Mm-hmm. And we're proud of you too, Lori. You know, you're someone to look up to. No, that's true, because, and I always tell it like it is. I just don't, there's no sense in not doing that. But, you know, like a lot of people would have given up. Okay, I would have given up. You know, with what you're going through as a kid, and then there either give up or you get tough. It seems like there's nothing in the middle. You know what I'm saying?
And, I got tough when I had my son. That's when I got. When I had my son, that was it. And I was like,
it gave you something to live for.
Yeah, I mean, I told you he is handicapped. He has bipolar disorder, and he's ADHD, and a few other things that he'd rather me not know. And since he's old enough that I don't have to know, then I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a handful. And basically, when I'm not involved in my medical, I'm here taking care of him, you know, because it's an everyday thing. you know, somewhere I could have gotten out and done other things that I would have wanted to. I mean, I only got as far, I went down to D.C. for the March 10 child abuse, but that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get out of the house to do anything because I got to keep an eye on him. You know, and I got to stay strong. And I got to stay strong. And everything that I go through, I mean, like my cancer, what did I have? I had 13 operations already. I had to keep showing him that you can come from it and, you know, still move. Because he's got some, like, physical problems that he's having to deal with, like knee replacements and stuff that shouldn't have happened. And I'm like a model for him. You can get up. It's going to be bad for a while. You know, you got to go through this to get there, and then soon you'll get up. And that's what he watches, and that's the reason that I keep moving. Otherwise, I'm tired. I'm ready to go to sleep. You know, I did my bit. You know, and I filled up all my walls with all my artwork. You know, there's no other reason for me to be here. That was it. You know. I mean, there might come a time when the pain gets, like, too much, because I won't take any kind of pain pills. You know, I'm in severe pain, but I won't take it because I have to be alert. And I've learned to live with it, believe it or not, by changing my focus onto a lot of things. So kids for me and helping people and all that, you know, it does. And then all of a sudden you turn, like I said, 65. I didn't picture it. I never did. And it was just
That's so true, Lori. One thing we always say on NASCA, okay, is if we go out and help other people, two things happen. Number one, you take the focus off of self, right? You have aches and pains. We all have these awful aches and pains because a lot of us have been beaten, right? And it does scar the mind, the body, the soul, and everything else. Believe me, you know that, and I know that.
Yep.
But if we sit and we think about it, that can, like, bring us down, and then we're no good to anybody, you know, not ourselves, not to anyone else, you know. If, however, you go out and help someone.
That's what happened to the rest of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm at the point where now I could see what the damage, you know, from what I could see each individual, and none of my sister didn't make it. My brother didn't make it. I know his kids were in jail. You know, everybody just fell apart on that, of them. Everybody but me. Mm-hmm. And they had no hope for me. And what's amazing, that the only amazing thing that I can find about myself really is how the brain is, like, still going when it's parts that aren't going. I haven't figured out how it works. I think I was 17. Yeah, I know. I came into the front door, and I heard someone in the back, in the Cape Cod, the kitchen's in the back. Someone was, I guess, on the phone, so I said hello. And it turned out it was Andrew, and he told me to shut up. And at that point, I wasn't taking any more of his crap, so I was going back and forth, you know, you shut up, no, you shut up. It went really, really bad. So I got myself into the living room. I was just going to leave him screaming around and hear the phone go down. And it had turned out it was a prospective employer, which I didn't know, and he didn't get the job. And he attacked me. He attacked me in the living room. He grabbed me by my throat, and he kept pulling me up above his head with his two arms. And there's only a year between us, so I don't understand, but the strength that crazy people have. So he was throwing me around like a rag doll, kicking me. Well, every time he would drop me, he would start kicking me in the ribs. I mean, he did break my ribs. He picked up the Lazy Boy recliner. He threw it on me. I mean, he did all that. And he wasn't stopping because I've never seen him so enraged. And I guess I was getting heavy as I was passing out. And I woke up because I hit the fireplace edge, slit my throat, I mean my leg. And I saw him still screaming to whoever he was screaming at. And I just got up and I ran up those stairs and I locked the door. And he's still screaming. You know, it took me to get my neighbor to come over. She was, her husband was a cop. So long story short, she was able to get him off me, but he crushed the front of my throat. So ever since that time, I have trouble swallowing to the point where I actually have a total of 4 trips to heaven. And my third one, I almost didn't get back. It took me 4 years to recover. I didn't know even who I was. I didn't know my house. I didn't recognize my embroidery pieces. I didn't even know what a phone was. I mean, so a lot of times I have to recover. And when you get, like, brain injuries like mine, I mean, even the neurologist, he told me, he says, Laura, you're never gonna recover. I'm sorry to tell you that, but you've had too many injuries. You've just lost too much oxygen. Because I'll choke 3-4 times a week, you know, totally pass out, wake up to a plate full of food. It just gets stuck. And I have an autoimmune disease that is closing my throat on top of that. So it's almost an everyday thing. This is why I don't eat by anybody, because looking at a person watching you choke is not very calming to me.
Yeah, it scares a lot of people.
It's not helping. It happened to my husband. I mean, the man froze. He was just like, oh, my God. And I told him, if you ever resuscitate me again, you're going to want it's going to need the ambulance, because he was the one. My son, he found me that third time. He found me dead in my chair. And it was my husband that I kept waking up to. All I know is I was having one hell of a time in the white lights. Oh, it's gorgeous over there. And then over time, the white was changing to gray. And I'm like, I want to go to the white. And I remember thinking these things. And it was him breathing into me. Yeah, right? I was like,
Wasn't it time yet, Lori?
Yeah, I was on the way.
Well, God has more. He has more things planned for you to keep talking to people and helping people, whatever you do.
I don't know what it is that brings people to me, because I don't really find myself all that interesting, because I'm basically a quiet person who, you know, does quiet things. You know, I'm not a very sociable. So I think I was born that way, and I am still shy. There's no doubt. No matter what I look like, my pink hair and all that stuff. but myself, I am still, you know, like, quiet. So through everything else, you know, I've always done stuff for kids in need. That was the cure all for me. I mean, I went through the therapy. I sought out, like, an incest therapist, and I saw her twice a week for 4 years, and I was journaling. I worked really hard to recover, because I didn't want to be that person I was. I was left as, like, a shell of nothing good, nothing. Nothing nobody wanted to be around, and, you know, and I was so socially delayed, because there was nobody. I didn't get really a friend until the 8th grade. I mean, because just from looking at me, I wouldn't even want to be around me. So I'm, like, not as far along as, like, my actual age. I should be further than I am. So, but, you know, it's like nothing that I can do about it. So I continue to make things like my pillows, and I make pretty blankets, and I do all kinds of things, you know, for where there's kids in need, because it helped me. It helped bring me out from those memories. I put good stuff in front of it, you know, after that hard work, you know. I reinvented myself is what happened. And I found a gift along the way. A lot of people don't know things. When I was 20, I found the world of embroidery. And from there, I mean, I was hooked, and it turned out I'm, you know, in museums, like, all over the world. It blows me away, because my personality does not match my work. That's what it comes down to. It's like, you ever, like, walk somewhere and you just happen to be somewhere and you figure out that's why, you know, something came to you. I have that
mm-hmm.
attitude that when the gift came down from heaven, it was like a bunch of, it just happened to fall onto me.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if someone's looking at it, I won't say I did it. I don't like the attention. I'm bad. I really am bad like that. You know, I made probably over 1,000 pillows. I only gave one child one pillow. I had my husband drop everything off. I just don't like being in that part because a lot of people do what I do, and nobody ever thinks, you know, about them. I mean, I'm just trying to make my way to the end of my life. And I am someone who has to keep doing something because I can't sit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a
That's
sitter.
Good, though, Lori. Lori, you know, we have another caller here. This is a 216 area code. Who am I speaking to?
It's me, Nancy.
Nancy who?
Me.
I'm teasing her. We have a, I don't know if you've been listening all night or not, you know, with the show here, but she's had such a wild, wild life. And I spoke to her on the phone a couple of days ago. I think we spoke for about an hour or something.
Yeah, and right?
It was at least that, I know. And you know, she is just so outrageously brave because of the life that she had. And she's still standing. And she's one of those people that could be, you know, people should look up to, you bet. I know she's bashful. She doesn't like praise and all this other stuff. But
you noticed.
I know. I could tell the other day. And, you know, but still in all, let me tell you something. She's not the type of girl that says, look at me, look at me, look at me, look what I can
do,
stand on my head and dance or whatever.
No.
She's very quiet. And I want to say something about that. Sometimes you say you don't know why you draw people to you. Now, look, I'm an extrovert. We all know this, okay?
Yes.
My daughter is too. My son, on the other hand, he's the introvert, okay? Everybody's different. But think about it. The people that you say you draw to you, they may be the ones that need the quiet person, not the extrovert. They may need that quiet time with someone who can treat them gentle, you know, and speak them calmly and not worry if they laugh or not. You know what I'm saying? Because I always make people laugh.
I agree.
And so, you see, you're doing your job very well because you don't have to stand out there with the sun and say, hey, I'm an advocate or whatever you want to put, you know, whatever. They come to you. So you're doing something right.
Lori. It's the body braces. I think a lot of it had to do with the body braces. Like, lady, what is wrong with you?
Standing? Well, thank God they're looking at your body braces, and they don't feel threatened then by you, do they?
No, they love
think
them
because
they decorate them. They decorate everything. Put me in the bed
Will you draw little hearts on them and stuff or something? What do you mean?
Them. You should take a look at my braces. Oh, no, I go all out. all those flowers, you know, the museums want my flowers. They always did, but I put them all over my braces,
mm-hmm.
because the braces itself are ugly, really, really ugly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
don't put me in bad frame of mind. You know, people like, you know, looking at the stuff. So, you know, only one person did I briefly hear that she said that poor, poor woman, and I felt like chasing her down and said, please do not, you know, feel pity for me because I'm not in that frame of mind where I'm a poor, poor woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a woman who got out of a wheelchair to get into those braces and start walking again. I don't see me the way other people do, but they don't know the story either. But I said, wheelchair was not fun. I said, I designed the braces with my brace man. I told him what I needed, where I needed it. And he had never done them before, and he was like, Lori, I really don't know if this is going to work. But he says, brace yourself because they're here. He put them on me. He says, you might fall, you know. But I took off on those braces and did not stop. I was out of that wheelchair.
No, good for you.
What a wonderful feeling. So,
well, I told both of my children, if I have to go into a wheelchair, it's got to be a cool one, all right? It's got to have a motor on it, all right?
Yeah. Don't forget the
skull.
Because
that's the way I am.
It's
got to be a really cool one.
I have to say NASCAR on there. You got to get that NASCAR right on that thing there. Yeah, you put it on. I used to make patches on the embroidery machine. I mean, I did loads of stuff. Yeah,
I remember you talking about that. I mean, I did hear your story before. It was a long time ago now, okay? But I do remember you talking about the patches that you made for shirts or whatever. That does come back to me. I do remember that.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing it. I started doing things for the, you know, kids' T-shirts on the machine. You know, cartoons and whatnot. And then I got into making patches with, like, actual words. Getting my brain to understand something is very difficult. But I got the NASCAR patch still in my machine. You know, I just couldn't use the machine anymore because my son's got this hyperacusis thing with his ear. He hears, he's got nothing to filter out sound. So I had to stop the machines. In the house now, I can't make a sound until he wakes up because he'll hear it. And we don't want to make cranky one cranky. Yeah, it's a hard. When you have a handicapped kid and you're handicapped yourself, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very hard. So
I'm sure
but,
it is.
But what am I going to do? You know, I didn't make me. it's like people think that they control everything they have around them and in their lives, and that's not how it goes at all. You only have a certain amount that you could control. You know, wherever you're going to end up going is where you're ending up going. It just happens that way. That's what I've learned at 60.
Nice.
I'll say at 60. So, yeah, life is strange. All these people now who are going through what they're going through, these horrors, these nightmares, and I see the people around here. And you know, I'll talk to any kind. And you find them in the streets. When I was, you know, like in my riding days, I would see the kids. You would have to actually go out like at night and you would find them. Those are the kids that need the help. And that was my thing. Why, you know, do anything else when the kids are on the street right in front of you? Go up and talk to them. You know, do this stuff while they're young. And that's what I used to do. Like I say, riding around on a pink bike, you know, they came right over to me. There wasn't any kind of problem. They're like, lady, I didn't know it was going to come out as this color, but yeah, whatever it takes to attract the kids, you know, that's what's needed because they're the ones. And the kids and the generations from these kids that weren't saved or didn't even have anyone to encourage them at any point in their life. I mean, luckily I had an adopted family that I met at 16. It totally changed my life. But for these kids that aren't having it, and they're having kids, and they're making TV shows about moms at 15 having kids. I mean, this is crazy. You know, something needs to be done, you know, to help these kids, and I wish I knew what it was. I honestly wish I knew what it was that would actually get other people who are doing, you know, watching TV or nothing, involved in the communities, too. You know, look
for
the kids on the street. Don't run from them. You know, we've got gangs here and whatnot. You know, there's certain times you don't go out, but there's times when there's regular kids. That's when you go out. You know your neighbors, do all that kind of stuff. That's what I do. You know, I know the kids around me, and I help them with whatever I can help them with. I mean, I keep a lot of kids. I donate a lot of stuff. I mean, even I had to stop doing my colorings. I did those for the longest time, but I've got like a neuropathy in my hands, so I can mm-hmm. hold the markers. So I gave them, you know, to kids, to Girl Scouts, everything that I, you know, was doing for them, I would donate it. So somebody uses it. A lot of people, they don't think to do that. And
no, they
don't. A lot
don't.
Of times, I'll, like on Facebook, I'll post things hoping people will be like, oh, that's a good idea. Maybe I can do that too. You know, so it's like a two thing when I show up what I do. That's what's needed.
Well, you're like an example, okay? That's what you are. You're an example for the young and also maybe even for those who are a little bit older as to, gee, I wonder what I could do, you know, in the community. What could I do, you know, for the kid next door or for the guy down the street, the people who are homeless? I've worked with them. A lot of them came from backgrounds like we did, okay, with all the beatings and all that stuff. And the drugs right in the family. A lot of times that's generational many times. So, but if you, you know, go up to them quietly, calmly like you would, and I learned to do that with those kind of people, you know, which was my kind of person too. Believe it or not, at one time I was very bashful. Me, bashful. But I don't know quite what got me over. I know. I don't know what got me over that exactly, but it happened. And
it
I admit
did.
Now that that I'm more verbal, I certainly can go out and be, you know, an example or help a lot of people in a lot of different places. Because
and you've
you
done
know,
that.
I do go
I mean, God, I mean, your yeah. devotion, Bill's devotion, everybody in Nashville, mm-hmm. the devotion that they have to put in, you know, that comes from your heart. It comes from your heart. Who
yes.
you are. It's just who you
yes.
are. So we need
That's
to
right.
get more of those people who have it in their heart to put it in their brain and realize, you know, hey, maybe there is something, you know, I can do. And refreshingly, I mean, I found a couple of neighbors here that are involved with the kids. And I was like,
mm-hmm.
oh, thank God, you know, please, I mean, do something with these poor kids. Get them away from the parents. I mean, when I used to have to take my son to the doctors and, you know, I could tell it's not a kid that has the problem so much. It's the parent driving the kid nuts that has the problem.
That's right.
And I would,
oh my God,
I would start I would go right into the middle, you know, wherever they were, and I would start talking to the parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I never got kicked out. I never did get kicked out, but, you know, I was like, get off the kid's back already, you know. Oh, we could tell it's you. It's not your kid. It's you.
Well, you know, it's so true, though, Lori. I mean, if you really, you know, people are so quick to say, oh, look at that kid out on the street. Look at how they're behaving. And look at the kids, the way they're behaving today, right? You go into that kid's house. Yeah. You go into that kid's house. And you will see why, okay, probably after about 10, 15 minutes, why that kid has a problem.
Yeah.
Because it really
yeah.
starts at home. You know that. I know that. Everyone should know that. You know,
and today,
dysfunction.
It's like there's more kids than there are professionals to take care of these kids and to guide these kids. The kids are just like overrunning everything. Around me, I mean, we've got houses. It's all single family, but you have four and five people, five families in one house.
Yeah.
So there's like a tremendous
yeah.
amount of kids. And how do you grab them from going, you know, over to the other apartments where all the gang members, you know, are? It's very not good for the kids today.
Well, that's why
so.
Communities need to have more, you know, that there's kids that are right on the line of being good or bad. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And if you can reach those kids that don't go into the gangs, that don't join the gangs, you go to them first, because then you're what you're doing is you're helping to keep more kids from, you know, turning bad. And you get them involved in wholesome things that are interesting, you know, to them. Now, that's what the communities need. And then, yes, too, you never turn your back even on a kid, you know, who is out there maybe doing trashing this and trashing that, starting the fires and all this other stuff. Remember where they came from, okay? I worked with kids that started fires and the ones that hurt animals and things like that.
it comes from the home. And we need for people to work also with them. So that's the only way we're going to, you know, save the kids, you know, is by doing those two things, you know, the two different groups there. But you're the type.
I
had an organization.
Go ahead.
Could I interject something for a minute?
Oh, sure.
Go ahead, Nancy. You have something to say? Go ahead.
Okay. One of the things that I noticed, like, especially when it comes, like, to some of my grandchildren, one of the issues is, you know, the kid may want the help. I actually have been dealing with that within the last year, where one of my grandsons, because of the mom, because of the house, just like you said, but, you know, I can only do so much because he's a minor.
It brings attention. Sometimes it's like the people on the inside that are doing all the damage actually think that nobody on the outside knows what they're doing. And when you confront them, you know, it's like, oh, you know what I'm doing to my kid over here. I go for those people.
I don't come out and try to bash the mom because I want to see my grandkids, or at least these certain ones. It's so many different things, but my grandson had a very bad thing happen at age 14 and was in juvie, this and that. And I tell you, I literally busted my ass trying to find community stuff. Like, in other words, before we went to court, they have this thing out here called Golden Ciphers. And it's sort of like, it was a summer program for last year, year ago, where, and I go to a chiropractor as well, and I said, you know what? I said, this would work out great. I could drop you off. It's like 10 blocks away from my chiropractor. I'll go get my treatments and stuff, which is about an hour, hour and a half, and I'll just come back and hang out. He was all for it. I said, you know, this way it's like community service. This, it'll look good when you go back to court. She wouldn't make him available. Now, I don't understand that. He was wearing the ankle bracelet and stuff. I mean, what do you do? The kid was
sometimes, it has to be the person themselves wanting so badly not to be.
You mean the mom or the kid?
No, it could be the kids that they just want to make that break. I mean, my sister turned into my mother.
My grandson couldn't just say, you know, like,
know you
let
do.
Me put it this way. I'd be a kidnapper. If I come to the house, mom says no, he's a minor.
You can't do anything.
Not unless I'm a guardian.
That's right. But what can be done, Nancy, let me say something to her about this. All right, the kid's on probation, too. I mean, he's going to be if he's not. I mean, he's just walking around with the ankle bracelet. You could call probation and say, you know, that you're the grandmother and you love your grandchild.
I did all that.
Hold on a second.
Okay.
Hold on a second. Tell them what you just told us, that you go to the chiropractor and you think that it would be good for, you know, your child to be a part of, you know, doing something for the community. And they're supposed, the probation department is supposed to, you know, a lot of times you'll see people cleaning up garbage in certain areas, and you know that they're, you know, the bigger ones, they're prisoners, right? But they use the kids, too, for other things. And they should be doing that with your, you know, grandson. Because they're trying, that's a part of teaching them, you know, this is what you do. This is the right thing to do. It gives them motivation, especially when there's a bunch of them together. And they learn that you don't go out and destroy things, whatever you're doing, you know, setting cats on fire, whatever you're doing, whatever, breaking the people's houses.
He tried
to rob
them. Well, he was being accused, him and two other friends were being accused of allegedly trying to rob a EMS worker in the neighborhood after they got off shift with a gun.
Well, this is a kid that really needs to turn around, you know, and but you have to give them something positive. And probation should know that.
Right.
I'm a little bit surprised at that. How old is he?
Out here, it's very bad conditions with juvenile detention.
That's where he used to work.
With,
how old is he? How old is he?
He just turned 16. He was 14 16. When it happened. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's a tough age.
It is a tough age.
It is very much so. And he's so different, like, when he's with me. You know,
mm-hmm.
when he came out of juvie and he gave me a great big hug and he said,
mm-hmm.
you know, now that I'm out, he says, maybe we could, you know, do things together.
That's what I'm saying,
you know?
That the person themselves is
mm-hmm.
at some point is going to have to realize
mm-hmm.
if they want to
right.
be their true self. And not just what was made of them, that they're going
right.
to have to be strong and just move forward. And it'll be
but
the different one. Say no
to
other people.
So. Mom and or guardians has the legal say-so. If mom, you know, just like a kid gets invited to a birthday party. If the mom says no, they can't do an overnight. No, they can't go. Another parent can't come over, pick up the kid because it's kidnapping. You can't do it. Mom rules, or dad, or both.
It's
very tough in Ohio. Very, very tough.
See, with
yeah,
my relatives, it was just so much easier because they didn't want their kids associated with us, especially my brother. I mean, because he got my cousin arrested at too young of an age. So there was actually nobody, you know, put in place. There was no cousins that we had. Aunts or uncles or even grandparents, you know, that would step in. So it was like when you're out on your own, you're out on your own. You know,
that's
you
right.
only can feel better about yourself and learn things when people show you things or talk to you or take an interest in you. You know, they just can't, you know, turn their back on you. And at 16, that is the hardest years, I think, from, let's say, 14 to 17.
Mm-hmm.
That is, those are very, very difficult years for kids. You know, they either make them or break them. So it's like the younger you get them, the, you know, even whatever you think is, like, not even of any importance. But even if you wave to a kid in a car, and this kid has no attention, of course they're going to actually like, oh, there's somebody out there who notices me, you know. It doesn't take much, you know, and that's what people aren't doing. You know, they don't even meet eyes anymore, and that's a problem.
You know what the problem is? Let me tell you something. This is making me hot under the collar, and I'll tell you why. Some years ago, they had the big brothers and big sisters, all right? They still do. But I don't think they're even as good today as they were years ago. I know that because my daughter had a big sister because I was out working all the time and she was alone. My son's a little bit older and he had friends. She didn't. So I got her a big sister. She was wonderful. She did everything with Michelle. She took her to the movies. She did this. I give her money, of course, you know, and all this other stuff. And when she went back to college, this girl, my daughter, just cried and cried and cried. Because she had gotten close, and it was good for her, though, to have that attention. She needed it, and she was teaching her right from wrong. She was able to. The kid would listen to the little older kid. Kids listen to kids, all right? That's the way it is. Juvenile detention doesn't really teach kids anything, especially if they don't have enough counselors, okay? It's just a place for them to stay. They wait before they go before the judge. We take them in. We took them in before the judge. They decide whether they go back home or whether they go into, you know, something else, a different program of some sort, and maybe not have a home. So, you know, it's not giving them any hope. It's not teaching them right from wrong. They did attend school. They had teachers there at detention that were trained to work with emotionally disturbed kids. But where did that emotionally disturbed kid come from, you see? It turns back into the family, the family, the family. So we had this program on that I'm very well aware of, and I brought them onto the show. And they're located in Newark. And, Bill, you remember who they were, okay?
Yeah.
Winona's house.
Yeah.
They worked with the whole family structure. See, there's the difference. And I'm shocked at probation because now they're located in a lot of different areas. Now, if I remember the last show he was on, he said it's not just in Newark, but they have like satellite divisions. But, you know, programs like Winona's House, they work with the kids, they work with the parents, and even if they think they've got them all straightened out and they screw up again, they're willing to come right back, and they talk to them again, they help them get jobs, they help them with all different kinds of things. There are services still out there. There's only one Winona's House, as far as I'm concerned. Now, Where are you from, Nancy? I don't know. I'd have to look it up. But where are you from?
Maine.
Me?
Yeah. Where are you from?
Yeah, yeah.
Ohio.
Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm gonna look into that on my own because you see, there should be some program out there working with kids, all right, who are in detention.
They have a program, but the program.
All right. Go ahead.
How could I say it? They have program. It's like out here, the right hand never wants to shake the left hand. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You have a program, nobody to enforce it. You have the juvenile system, but their stuff is more of the courts and the legal. They don't, like, in other words, when I try to find out, okay, is there any way that he could, like, he wants to go to Golden Ciphers. He wants to. But he's a minor. Mom's making him unavailable. You go to pick him up. Oh, he's not here. Well, he said he wanted to go. There's no way to, it's not court order enforceable. That's the problem.
That's the problem. Exactly.
The programs are there, but nobody's going to enforce it. It's free will like church. You know, yeah, a parent could make a kid go to get up early on Sunday and go to church, or they could say, okay, you don't want to go to church, fine, but give me the cell phone for a week. You know, it's
You see, that's the problem right there, Nancy. You see, here's the problem. You have a kid who has some positive ways about him and you know, claim things that he'd like to do, you know what I'm saying? But you don't have the court system on your side. And that's very bad.
No.
So I have to look into it. I will look into it. I'll talk to you later. Because the show is almost over.
Yeah, it's the Cleveland area.
Yeah. Let me look into that. All right, it says here, Lori concludes, we all have purpose, even if we don't like it. And the bottom line is you don't have to repeat what you have done, or what was done to you, rather. We're all broken, but we can be fixed to a certain degree. She's nearly 65. My body is in shambles, but I chose to help rather than to hurt. Now, you see, she's talking about choices, and she was talking a little bit about choices, too, with your grandson. And when he gets a little bit older, and this is a very rough age, I admit that. I mean, I have chased kids down the street to grab a hold of them by the back of the neck and say, hey, I care. I want to help you. I'm not a cop. I want to help you. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I'm just letting them know that they don't have any threat from me. So, and then they'd listen. But you see, your grandson shows positive ways, and by your daughter or daughter-in-law, whatever she is, by doing what she's doing, she's actually hurting the situation. So I'm going to look into that. Now, Lori, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Please
listen here. Don't be a stranger. You can call in and be in on the panel.
I know.
I'm
pretty much recovered, I guess, as much as I'm going to be from the last, you know, stroke. You know, my thing is I get worried that people don't understand everything I'm saying because my brain isn't getting out the words. Every time you have a lack of oxygen, you're losing something. So sometimes I can't even have a conversation.
Well, you did fine tonight, sweetheart. Yes, you did.
Yeah, I was very worried. I was worried about tonight.
I wasn't.
Yeah, let me tell you something. Yeah, go ahead, Bill. Go ahead.
No,
she did.
I had every confidence in her. You know, You're selling yourself too short, Lori.
I know. I have that problem. That was from childhood. I'm better now.
Okay. Well, yeah, I love you.
She did a fine job.
I know other people recognize who you were once you got talking and so forth. And, you know, we care about you.
Thank you.
You're one of the oldest standing members of NASA, so thank you.
Oh, well, I was glad to come back to show that you can survive.
That's right. Definitely
can.
Well, there you go. And that's the final statement right there. You can survive even the worst type of past. Okay? And cool. And you put here, but I chose to help rather than hurt. And you certainly have a lot of reasons to hurt physically, mentally, emotionally, every way. But you chose to help instead of hurt. And I think you're an inspiration. That's what I think.
Thank you so much.
We love you, all right? Please come back and be on the panel.
I'll do my best, I promise.
Okay, I'm going to call you once in a while. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay, good. Okay, I have to end the show. So anyway, thank you so much for coming on and telling your story again and showing us how brave you are, because that's what you are. And Nancy, I'll see what I can do with that. I'm going to look into it. Every state is different, you know that. They have each different laws, and in a sense, there's certain things that shouldn't be like that. But I'll see what I can do about programs out there. And I'll talk to the lady. I'll fix her. She's hurting her son, you know, in spite of you, whatever. We'll talk off the phone, okay? Is she still there, Nancy? I don't think she's still there. Okay, anyway, all right. Good night, everybody, and we'll be back again on Monday. Good night. God bless. Stay safe.
Night, girl.
Good night.
No tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.